Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:37 p.m. on Friday, March 24th, 2017. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, myself, Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Gren, and Guttenberg. And Representative Thompson is excused from today's meeting. And before we start, please mute your phones. And at this meeting, we'll be addressing HB 111, which is the oil and gas production tax payments and credits. And today we'll have a presentation from first Colleen Glover, commercial analyst from the Department of Revenue, and then after that, Castle Gap Advisors. So Ms. Glover, if you could come up. And so I think it looks like, Ms. Glover, you've got a 32-page slide presentation. I think what we're going to try and do is spend an hour with you and then an hour with Castle Gap Advisors afterwards, and they're going to be going through the modeling. So we'll spend an hour with them. So with that, if you could put yourself on the record, and Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Just before we start, thank you for giving me. I had passed out for people, and it was done the other day. Two pages of maps, and they are the sedimentary basins. And I just wanted to show people what is Middle Earth, as defined. Pretty much, it's everything besides Cook Inlet and the North Slope and. The circle areas on the second page are the active basins. So, just to give you a perspective on what we're looking at when those terms are used. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Ms. Glover, so you've got a 32-page. Is it a PowerPoint that we're going to be looking at? Do we have copies of that here? We do. Okay, that's in our packets here.
That's nice.
Here it is.
It's not up online though.
Oh, okay.
It's not that one.
And
we're going to be watching it. There's going to be no
that one.
We need to switch it.
Let's.
Yeah.
Let's take a brief it is
Friday.
Okay, House Finance is back in order, and with that, looks like we'll be starting with this three-page PowerPoint here, which is entitled Model Session. So if you could, all three of you, just put yourselves on the record and proceed.
Rich Ruggiero with Castle Gap Advisors.
Colleen Glover, Department of Revenue, Tax Division.
Christina Ruggiero, Castle Gap Advisors.
Okay. Today, before we start, we just want to give you an idea of what you're going to see overall. With the models that we have in here, we didn't want it to be dueling models. We wanted it to be compatible models that we could move forward. And we have been working this morning with the DOR to make sure that what we put up, that we're getting similar results, because the last thing we want to do is waste your time with having models that get vastly different results and then having you to decide which one's a better model or whatnot to go back and forth. So we have had a very productive session both yesterday and today, and kind of looking at the models and double checking the logic that we're using as we run through them to make sure. And we're able to run some things today and get close. But when we come back up after the DOR, I will go through some of the things that we did find in our modeling and then go through our model. But what I just want to put up is that Ms. Colleen here has her presentation that she's going to run through, and she's got a large and small field, and then what we're going to run through is a model that does sort of the one-year snapshot at various price levels. where it is totally interactive, that we can run any gross tax you want. We can run any sliding scale that you want. We can run any royalty, any cost basis, et cetera. So that way you can see, compared to what you have today on the books, what the results would be. So we just want to talk, we come sort of two different constructs. One is a life cycle, one is the snapshot, but one, our snapshot is informative as to the relative amounts of money that would move in or out of the state coffers based on certain actions taken. And again, so just the construct you got is, Colleen will go through a life cycle model. We have the sort of delta price model. And neither one of them are really set up to run fiscal note type detail. And so if someone said, well, how does this impact Cook Inlet or Middle Earth or North Slope specific to these two fields, we can't do that. We don't have access to that data to do that because we don't have the exact operating parameters for all that. That's something that the, my understanding is DOR has, and they can run it upon request. So what we're going to have is something that is functional enough for to give you an idea of where things are, relatively speaking. And then if you want specific detail, that can then be requested through the DOR. Okay?
That's all. We'll turn it over. We'll step back.
We've got a quick question from Representative Guerra, and I believe it might be for Rich.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. For Rich or Christina, we got some information the other day, and I thought you might have had an added piece of information that I don't have. So in the sort of Conoco presentations on their annual reports, and we still can't find the full 2016 annual report, they showed that I think they had a page that showed at roughly $41 a barrel, their net profit in Alaska was a little bit over $250 million. That was, and then we have the, from the Department of Revenue, the average sort of break-even point for an average North Slope field, like not every North Slope field, but the average North Slope field, which I think is about $40 FY17 and $42 roughly at FY18. So we have those numbers, what the break-even point is. But for Conoco, we had them, what they showed was $266 million in profit at 41-something dollars a barrel for FY16, but they didn't show what their break-even point was. And I thought I heard a mention that maybe either of you might know what their break-even point was, or maybe you don't. That's the only piece of information I'm looking for. We know what they made at that price, but we don't know what their break-even point was.
Representative Garrett, the chair, I don't know what their break-even point is, but during their presentation, they did use a slide from their latest analyst presentation, which I believe is in the fall of 2016. In that presentation, there are two slides which specifically address Alaska. On one of them, they show that from 2012 through 2016, they were able to reduce what they call their all-in, all-inclusive, 10% rate of return price level from, I think it's, was it Christina, 63? We can get the exact slide, but I believe it's from 63, they're down now to $40. And based on the footnote, that means at $40, they have an all-in, all-cost included 10% rate of return for their Alaska operations.
Thanks.
Okay. With that, let's go ahead and move into Ms. Glover's presentation, maybe let's go ahead and let her get through her presentation. And so unless you've got a clarifying question, let's go ahead and hold questions until the end and get through the presentation, and then we'll get to questions. So please proceed.
Thank you for the opportunity to come speak to you on Friday, the last day here, but I appreciate to be here and share information to help you make decisions on the oil and gas tax bill before you. So kind of Rich Ruggiero kind of alluded to what I'm doing, and we call it life cycle modeling. It's looking at a hypothetical new field, right? This isn't based on any current field, and it's made to look at a small field, large field, and we can change whatever parameters we can. We assume it's a GVR field that we talked a lot about yesterday because it is a new field and it would qualify at the, our base case is the 12.5% royalty and 20% GVR. but it's a way just to look at the impact of total revenue on the state, total revenue for the producer, and also for the federal and muni take as well. But it's a way just to kind of look at, you know, there's been a lot of recent announcements, take those numbers and put it through the model and see what the benefit is to the state and producer. And we look at status quo. What I call status quo is the current tax law, or we look at the new current House Bill 111 in its form. So I know this week there's a lot of sectional analysis on the bill, and there's a lot of sections on the bill that don't really impact the economics of a field. And so the items in green are the pieces of House Bill 111 that do impact the modeling. So we've talked a lot about the net operating loss credit, right? It was a rate current is a 35% credit, and the new bill, it's become a loss at a 50% with an uplift. There are some changes to the sliding scale per barrel credits that impact the economics of a field. We've eliminated cash repurchases. And just to clarify, this is just looking at a North Slope field for this example. So there's no more credit repurchase of any kind for North Slope fields with the new House bill. And then there were some changes to minimum tax rates based on price. And then another one of the new things you've heard this week is that the minimum tax for a GVR field is now based on their reduced gross value. And then the minimum tax, those two items there are changing, and that's what we call hardening the floor. So those items in green are what you'll see changing and the economic impact of those. So just to kind of go through kind of what we do in the model, it assumes production starts or development starts January 1st, 2018. This does not include exploration costs. It's really from the point that the decision is made to develop and produce a field. We use a price and cost inflation based on the Callan estimate, the 2.25%. Also, there's the provisions on the gross value reduction and whether they go to minimum tax or use other credits. So we model one way that they're just going to pay minimum tax. And also there's been talk about the $35 million current level for repurchasable credits or the $70 million at the reduced rate. We just assume that they'll go with the 35. So when we look at the fields, the model is robust and it can model any size field. We just kind of stick to kind of some protocols to kind of show a representative small field, which is what we call like a 50 million barrels oil total production, and then a large field, which we have defined as 750 million barrels of total production. But those can be changed any numbers. We typically just focus on four different oil price points, of 40, 60, 80, and the current forecast. So we'll be using the fall forecast is in there. And so we'll show you the results of current tax provisions on a small and large field, and then the proposed tax provisions on a small and large field. And so what I'll show you is what we've defined as a dashboard. It's a way to kind of consolidate all the information. It's a pretty complex model with all the tax code built into it, but to give you kind of snapshot of what's the impact is on production tax by year for the life of the field, the state revenue by year, the producer's take by year, and then there's kind of the summary economics. And Rich was here yesterday, kind of talked a lot about internal rate returns and NPV, and so you'll see some of that in here as well. So I wanted to go slide by slide, not to talk about the numbers in these graphics. We'll talk about this later, but just to explain what each of these quadrants is showing. So top left quadrant is showing production tax by year. This scenario is showing a small field, which we show 30 years. So you can see every year how much production tax is received to the state, or in this case, it's when we have cash purchases. So you'll see the negative bars is those are credits being purchased by the state. You'll also see the kind of orange line is the minimum tax level. In the top right quadrant, we'll have a state revenue by year. So this, and this is broken out by production tax. You'll see the royalty. It includes property tax, which is a very small line, and it doesn't really show because the state's getting a very small share of the property tax on the North Slope. They're getting the 7.5%. But the local government's receiving that, and you'll see that in some other slides. But the state's getting pretty minimal. And then this also includes state income tax as well. So it's total state take. And so then the bottom left corner is showing the producer cash flows. So you'll see in the beginning is when they're investing a lot of money, and then they start producing and then recovering some of their and having some positive revenue. And then this bottom quadrant is kind of the total economics picture. So it's aggregating all the dollars that you saw in the other slides by year into total. So you'll see the total production tax, the total state share, the total producer share, and then also their NPV and internal rate of return. And then the little pie charts, you'll see you'll see where the muni shows up in here and the federal percent in here as well. Either it's a share of total of profits or of the gross value. So next I'll go into real scenarios, and so I'll compare a small field under the current tax law and then the proposed tax law, and you can see the impact on all parties from that. So for a small field, we assume it's a 30-year life of the field. There's production curves. I'll show you one. The peak production is about 15,000 barrels a day in this scenario. We assume a transportation cost of $10. We assume these have a royalty rate of 12.5%, but like I said, all these parameters can change and we can look at it different ways. We have kind of an assumption we use on prices, so a per barrel, $18 per barrel capital expenditures and a $15 a barrel operating expenditures, and those convert to their lease expenditures that are then deductible from their gross value. Have a flat rate for property tax as well, and a corporate tax and federal income tax assumptions built into the model. So here's the production profile and cost profile curve that we use for a small field. You can see the blue is their investment, and then in this one in the small field, they don't actually start producing any barrels until year four, and then the green curve goes up from the production curve. So they're investing a lot of money before they even produce a barrel of oil. So this is the small field based on current tax. And so you'll see the results of all the things we just talked about. So this is based on fall forecast prices, and it's the current House Bill 247 law. I don't know if you guys want to go in detail on this or look and ask questions later. And so to explain here on where it has a partner, right, so the tax laws are based on producer or partner. It's not based on the field. So one field doesn't get, it gets taxed by whoever, you know, is producing the oil. So in a small field, we assume there would probably be a single partner, but in a larger field, it could have multiple partners. So we do look at multiple partner scenarios because it will change the tax and the impacts on the state. So you can see, so here's current, right? So here's with the cash credits. At the beginning on the top left, where the producer is able to get cash credits. So this assumes just based on tax law, not based on appropriations or budget or anything. This is just according to tax law. So they're able to get up to $35 million a year for cash credits. So you'll see in the beginning, they're able to recover some of their costs by the cash repurchases from the state. And it isn't until about year 7 or 8 that they're actually paying any tax on the green line to the state. And so it's really visually apparent when you go to current House Bill 111 without any cash repurchases. I mean, the state still isn't getting any money until they start producing, but yet then they'll start getting revenue right away, the production tax. And at the beginning, you'll see they're only paying up to minimum tax level. So anytime that the green bar is above the orange line, it means they're paying more production tax than minimum tax.
Mr. Kutcher?
Representative Curran?
Just a clarifying question. The prices, these are the 2016 forecast prices, mm-hmm. steady for the 30 years?
No, it changes over the year. I can, it's in the RSB.
For
yeah.
the next
30
years?
Yes. Yeah. The next year is 54, and then it goes up from there every year in the fall forecast.
Glover, I wonder if, as you go through, would you mind using the laser pointer? Just
oh, yeah. Okay, and I know you had one. Does it work on all of the screens? Oh, and this one worked. Okay. So on here, you'll see, like, this starts at year one. And so across this period, it's zero. So there's no tax being paid because they are not producing any oil. So there's no production until they hit to year five. And then in this period here, because they're recovering their losses based on those new carry-forward NOLs, they're just at minimum tax level. And then once they've exhausted all those NOLs, then they're paying at the full rate in the production tax up here. And you'll see similar over here, right? They're not paying anything. There's no royalty. There's no production tax. There's no revenue to the state until they start producing barrel oil. And then you'll see this, you know, this screen is same as this. And then here from the producer side, you'll see, right, they are spending a bunch of money up front until they start producing, and then they're generating positive cash flow. And then so these box here on this quadrant, this the net production tax total, is the aggregate sum of all these bars. Same as the net state gain loss here is the aggregate of all of these over the life of the field, which is you've defined as 30 years for a small field. Same thing for the net producer cash flow. It's all those bars added up. And so I said we modeled under four different price scenarios, the 40, 60, 80 in the fall forecast. We've just put that data into a table instead of giving you the dashboard for all those. I think it's a lot to have to do, but this gives you the data from each of those. So you'll see in the column for oil price where the price has changed, and then you can see these numbers. It's pretty much the same that was on the little bottom right corner of the dashboard. So at least you can see the difference at different price points for status quo, which is current tax law, and House Bill 111. And this is just a way to kind of show the difference between the green is the state cash flow and the blue is the producer cash flow under all eight of these different scenarios for a small field. So you can see this is the oil price, and then this is the tax regime. So for fall forecast, current, here's the state cash flow, and that's the producer cash flow. So it's a way to kind of see it instead of numbers.
Would you mind, just for transcription purposes, I guess we may need to point to the screen. Or if on the computer, I don't know if you can use a little cursor to point to where you are.
I would do it on the cursor instead.
And then okay. Also, you might want to pull on the microphone just a little bit so they can hear okay. Something. Okay.
Is there any questions on any of this on the small field?
We're going to hold questions till the
okay,
end,
okay.
If there's a clarifier.
So we'll go through some more just with what we've defined as a large field. There are some differences. The life of the field is 40 years. Of course, the production is different. the peak, and this one is about 120,000 barrels per day. Same cost, same royalty. There's a difference in the capital expense per barrel. It's 13, a little bit less, and OPEX, operating expense, is $12 per barrel instead of 13 in the small field. All other assumptions are the same. So this is a similar type of profile where years of investing before they produce in a large field, they start producing at year five. And so you'll see that in the graphics later as well. But then this is how, you know, the production profile and then their cost. So this is the impact of current tax on a large field. So you'll see similar. And so in this scenario, we did one partner because that does drive the amount of cash repurchased they're allowed to, right? It's $35 million per producer partner per year. So in this situation, there's one partner. They're able to get $35 million a year in a cash repurchase. And then about at year 12 is when they actually start paying any tax. And then they pay at the minimum level until they've exhausted all of their credit, their NOL credits. This is current tax policy. So you can see similar here where, you know, until they're producing, there's no, this is the credits here. And then at this point here, then you start producing and you get royalty income as well. Similar situation down here on the producer where this is all their investment cost. Then they start producing and generating a net income, positive income, for the rest of the life of the field. So you'll see this was with four partners. It's a pretty significant difference because they can get $140 million a year because they're each entitled to $35 million in credits under current tax. So you'll see it does impact the economics quite a bit in this situation because they're able to recoup their investments sooner. And so this is a similar field with the new HB 111, and the number of partners, it doesn't impact it because there is no longer the cash repurchases. So that's why it just says one or four, because it really doesn't matter. You'll see here in the beginning where it, until they start producing year five, then they start paying tax, and they're paying at a minimum tax until they reach about year 12, 13, and that's when they've exhausted all of the new carried forward losses that are part of the new House Bill 111. And then they're paying at the regular rate for the rest of the field life. So I know yesterday Representative Seaton asked about the higher GVR rate for a higher royalty. So I did do it for this scenario, for the large field scenario. So this one would be with the 6 2/3 royalty rate, which then they'd be entitled to a 30% gross value reduction. And so you'll see the difference from that if you kind of compare the slides side by side. You want to look at that. So it is like a net increase of state revenue by $2 billion for the life of the project. If you compare this one to slide 22. The state is getting more in royalty than they're giving up in production tax and loss reduced production tax. Because it's a higher royalty rate, right? They're getting more royalty money than they would in the 12.5%, but then there's a reduction in tax paid. Did you want to? So this is a 20% GVR, right? Over the life of the field, they'd pay $10.9 billion in production tax. And if they're at the higher royalty rate with a higher GVR, then it's $9.9 billion. So there's less revenue to the state from production tax, but more royalty. And amount of royalty is more than the reduction in the property tax. I mean, the production tax, sorry.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, and so what was the rate of royalty increase that you put in there?
So I used the 16 2/3 royalty rate. And then this is the comparison at the higher royalty rate with the higher GVR qualification with the 30%. This is the impact in a new H bill, House Bill 111. So as in the small fields and the large field, there are, we modeled all four price points for a one partner scenario, all four price points for a four partner scenario, and then the new bill. So there's a total of, well, this has actually 14 because I added the higher GVR. So this is kind of the table results. You'll see this column here with the GVR percent, where most of them are 20%, and then the two at 30. So you can just see the information in a table where you could kind of compare it a lot easier than kind of switching between dashboards. And then this is a graphical representation of the different scenarios, comparing the state take versus the producer take. And because there's quite a few things, there's like five different things in the current bill that are actually impacting the tax calculations and the modeling, kind of to understand it better, kind of broke out five of those five components like piece by piece, right? Because when you change the model, you're changing a bunch of different impacts, inputs, and so to kind of see what is really driving the difference, kind of did each step by step to see what the impact of each one of these five things, which is one's changing the NOL from a 35% credit to a 50% loss, and then the shift in the sliding scale credits at price points and the dollar amount, hardening the floor, changing the minimum tax, and then eliminating the cash repurchases. So the next set of slides will show kind of the relative impact of those change on the state from both the revenue and a net present value and the producer. So this is based on large field, one partner scenario. So this is starting at status quo, current bill, current tax code, what the state would get if this project came to be, $22.4 billion. Then the change of the NOL from the credit to the loss, that brings an additional $1.8 billion of revenue. The sliding scale credit change brings an additional $1.3 billion. And then you'll see hardening the floor is negligible, and these other, there's no impact of the minimum tax change and the cash repurchase from the cash flow. And then this yellow bar here, this is showing with the current tax, with the proposed tax law, that would be the total state net cash flow. So you start from where we are today, and then all five of these changes, and this is where you go. And this is looking at the same kind of information, but a net present value, which is different. And I know Rich Ruggiero talked about net present value a little bit yesterday. So some of these items will have an impact on a net present value because it's all about the time value of money and when you might receive the money or pay out the money. So even though they might not have a cash flow change, they could have an impact on the net present value. So this is similar. This is the state net present value. kind of what the total net present value is today, all these incremental tax policy changes, and where the state with the net present value is after all of the changes from House Bill 111. So this is showing from the producer side, similar thing. You'll notice, didn't point out that the gains and the losses, so these are kind of a negative cash flow to the producer, so it's bringing the value down step by step to their total cash flow with the new House bill. And then this is for the producer net present value, and you'll see the impacts are a little more significant, and especially the cash repurchase, where it really didn't have a cash flow issue, negligible, but for the producer, it's a significant change in their net present value calculations with elimination of those cash repurchases. And that's all I had. So.
And with that, I'm sure there's some questions. Any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Chair. When you were looking at the extra 10%, so you were comparing a field that had a 12% royalty, 12.5%, and then you looked at fields that had 16.2%. But you toggle those, did you toggle those together so you only applied the 16.2% the royalty if you also gave the GVR? I mean, it seemed like what was being said is the only time you have a higher royalty rate is if you have the GVR, where the royalty rates were already in place at 16.2%. And so it seems like we should look at it, what is this field, you know, life cycle at 16.2%, or what is this field life cycle with 16.2% and an additional 10% of value reduction. I don't think that that's the way this was done, right? This was only looking at if you applied both the higher royalty and the 10% GVR at the same time.
Correct. So then, right. So if the, because current tax is, if it's higher than 12.5% royalty, they qualify for the additional 10% GVR. But I can back that out and model it any way you want. So, yeah.
If you would do that, I'd appreciate it, because we had these fields that were bid at 16, were purchased at 16.2%. Without a GVR, and then a GVR was added later
right.
to try to figure out what that difference
is. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Gurr?
Thanks. Can you go to page 14, please? So the green bar, is that sort of your sort of the typical bar of oil production ramping up and oil production then starting to decline?
These are the profile curves that were developed before I started working here, but they, right, they're to represent, you know, kind of the ramp up, ramp down of production.
I guess, through the chair, one of the problems I've had is with, for the GVR fields that, and from the Department of Revenue, the evidence is the average field on the North Slope that is a GVR field, so a lower tax field, below $70 a barrel, no production tax for the first 7 years. And those first 7 years on this chart are from year 4 to year 11. We don't start taxing until the peak has fallen in, like, by half. And am I reading that right?
So on the Representative Garrett through the chair, on the fall forecast and the price forecast, they only qualify for 3 years of the GVR, not seven, because they've reached that 3 year max of over $70 after the first 3 years of production. So they're only getting the GVR for 3 years and in the large fields, in the small and large field scenarios with the fall forecast. So it's not 7 years in this model. Because of the price.
So fair enough. If prices are above $70 a barrel for 3 years, it's 3 years. But if they remain below $70 a barrel, then it's
right.
7 years, right?
Correct.
And so if it's 3 years under this chart, we don't start taxing until that peak year. We lose no production tax all the way up to that peak year. And if it's 7 years, it's no production tax until the peak has fallen in half.
Representative, go through the chair. Part of that is impacted, though, by their carry-forward credits from current or carry-forward loss, too. So it depends on that.
Another question?
Representative Guerra.
On page 17, and I'm just looking at a small field under the status quo. I guess that's line 2.
Mm-hmm.
At $60 a barrel,
mm-hmm.
and this I'm just trying to understand. So the state says net production tax paid negative $41 million. Is that the life of the field?
Correct.
And then the next line is net production tax with a net present value. It's negative $89 million to the state?
Correct.
That's production taxes minus deductions and credits, I take it?
Correct.
Okay. But at the end, the last line is the producer has an internal rate of return of about 11%. Does that mean that's somewhere in the profit world? Rate of return and profits have always been hard for me to translate.
Representative Kerr, through the chair, the internal rate of return is, you'll hear different companies say they have a different threshold to consider a project, so it's basically the rate where their net present value would be zero is how that's calculated. It's the rate of return that their net present value would be zero. So you'll see they have, or it equals the net present value rate, 10%. It's more an investment metric.
Representative Gere.
Just because other people might be faster than me, I'll only ask another question. So it's an 11% internal rate of return. Let's leave aside what a company says they need to make in order to move forward with the field. Is there some translation between an 11% internal rate of return that is sort of a net rate of return?
Representative Gere, through the chair, they are profitable at that point. You'll see, I mean, it's incorporating the time value of money into it. So you'll see their total net present value is positive. So there is positive investment.
One other question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gere.
Thanks. And then, Ms. Glover, just before you were talking about the GVR is a 20% GVR, mm-hmm. right? And then except for the higher royalty fields where it's like a 30% GVR. But a 20% GVR doesn't translate to a 20% discount in your tax rate. That translates into a sort of a bigger discount in your tax rate than 20% normally. Is that correct?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, that 20% is a reduction off your gross value before you even calculate your taxes. So it could have a bigger impact.
All right, thanks.
We've got Representative Guttenberg and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glover, just a couple of questions on your field assumptions. The difference between on 13 and to 20, the 50 to 750. The capex and the opex are significantly lower on the larger field. I mean, I understand economy of scales and everything, but these are significant numbers based upon barrels. Is that an accurate assumption of I'm asking if you're accurate, but it just seems a little awkward for me that there's such a big difference when you're the scale of your both capital and operation costs are so much.
Representative Guttenberg to the chair. Those assumptions were prior to me working in this job. We can get more information to give you better basis, but those were developed with Department of Revenue with consultants in the past. So I don't really have detail to explain.
One more question, if I may.
Representative Guttenberg, another one.
And the transportation costs, just the assumption, is that into TAPS by itself, or are there any other field transportation issues involved in that, distance from Pump 1 or anything like that?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, the transportation cost does include everything marine, all, and we are using just similar to the average that's in the RSB. We just round it to 10, but we can change it to anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on the same chart that we were on 17, so on the $60 for oil price, is that assuming the $60 is what the oil price is for the life of the field?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, $60 over life field, but it is inflated every year based on the 2.25% inflation factor.
So follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
So is that, I mean, I see much bigger swings, you know, from the years than 2%. So there was like, you didn't use like past data the last 10 years of those swings of what something like a $60 would start at and what it's gone up in the last 10 years. You're just, that's the only factor you put in.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, for this purposes, that's what we opted just to do different price points. It's similar to the price points you'll see in the fiscal notes, but the model would take any price we wanted to put in. So if we thought it was going to move 5-10% every year, that can be done. This was just to show some representative price point analysis.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
So if we could just read across this just so I understand. So still staying at the $60. So the 437 under net state gain, is that 437 that's paid to, what does that 437 represent?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. So those numbers are tied to the you don't have the dashboard for the $60 barrel, sorry. It's the total state revenue, production tax, royalties, property tax, and corporate income tax. So that's total state take.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
So would that be the same thing on the 100, so would I add the 437 with the 113 as far as the life of the field for the share for the state, and then would the producer one be the 550 and the 23? I'm just trying to figure out who takes what.
Right. Representative Wilson, through the chair. So the 113 is the state net present value. So that's taking the total revenues to the state over the life of the field, which in here is 30 years, and converting that into like dollars to represent the time value money. So they're not additive. They're based on similar information, but this 437 is money the state's going to get over 30 years, and the value of a dollar in 30 years is not the same as the value of a dollar today. So the state net present value is putting those in today's dollars, or 2018 dollars.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
So do I then take the 437 for the net state gain and compare that to the producer cash flow, so they keep 550 to the 437 they give us? Is that a kind of an apple to apple comparison?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, right, those are the same thing. This is total revenue over the life of the project to the state, and then the 550 is the total cash flow to the producer. So those are similar numbers. You could compare those.
Perfect. So follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So is it fair to say that the state, who hasn't taken any risk, hasn't had to put the money up front, gets to sit back and just collect with no risk, actually made 437, and the companies who took all the risk, and luckily at least during this scenario, came out well, made the 550? Based on everything else.
Representative Wilson, through chair, in this scenario with these assumptions, correct.
And then one more follow-up.
Follow-up.
So if I go down to the $80, then the state actually does better than the company because they made $1,108 and the producers only made $972.
Representative Wilson, through chair, correct. And
this is under current. So these are, if you look, it's under the current tax to the status quo is the current tax statute, and then you'll see the difference with the new House Bill 111. But yes, that is the way you're interpreting those correctly.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't have a follow-up. I'm just trying to make sure with all these numbers, we know what to compare apples to apples, and underneath the current system, it looks like we're doing pretty good for taking no risk in this whole situation. Thank you.
Ms. Glover, I've got a question. A big variable is how much, what the discount factor you use for both the state and the producer. And so for the state, you've got 6.95. Just curious how you, why you decided to use 6.95 to discount, and then for the producer, you're using 10%. Why did you decide to use that? And then why are they different?
So Chair Foster, the 6.95 is the rate that the permanent fund uses. And so that we thought in the state, you know, they would invest money in the permanent fund, that would be the rate of return. So we thought from a relative, that's kind of the state's expectation for investment. So we use that for the production tax, net present value percent, and the state take. And then the producer, knowing that they do take risk and they do have, you know, the cost to recover, we landed on a 10%. It can be changed, but we thought within the department that was a reasonable rate to use.
Okay. And so if you use a number smaller than 10%, then that makes the net present value for the producer go up at the $60 level from 23. It would be a higher number if you use, say, 9% or 8% or 7%, correct? Just want to let
right.
you know, I guess.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions?
Yeah.
Representative Kerr?
Thank you. I guess I don't understand the whole if the state takes no risk question. So we're doing the status quo. The state's still paying tax credits, right?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, correct. There's the, you can see the amount of the credits repurchased right. in the status quo.
And under the sort of the state taking no risk thing, I guess I disagree with it. Even under HB 111, the state will reimburse, but as a deduction from your taxes later on, unlike the normal capitalist model where the company pays things without state subsidies, right?
Representative Gare, through the chair, in the current, with the House Bill 111, their losses would be converted to a carried forward that would be treated as a, like any other cost for tax calculations.
Further questions of the committee? Seeing none, we'll move to the modeling with Castle Gap. Thank you, Ms. Glover. And let's take a brief at ease just so that we can get resituated. Okay, House Finance is back on record, and if we could have both of you put yourself on the record, your affiliation, and proceed. Looks like we're going to have see the modeling here, and so this is interactive, so it looks like we're going to allow folks to go ahead and ask questions throughout the presentation. So with that, go ahead and proceed.
Yes, my name is Rich Ruggiero with Castle Gap Advisors.
And Christina Ruggiero with Castle Gap Advisors.
General Foster, you're exactly right. This is, again, going to be a session where what we're here is trying to help you understand and decipher a number of the decisions that you have to make based on different aspects of HB 111. And what we've done is, I'll go back to what you're not going to see, which I had hoped to have presented today, is we have been working on a full life cycle model as well, to where you could look at various pieces back and forth, because that goes to the question of the NOLs. In putting our model together and comparing with the DOR, our numbers were well within the range that you would expect of error between two different people doing it, and they were very, very close. But it raised some issues because, and I just want to put this out, that we're going to continue to work on this so we can get some answers. But when you cut NOLs in half, my 40 years in the business says that should be a significant hit to my economics, and it wasn't. And, you know, intuitively it doesn't make sense, but I went through the numbers for 2 hours and they made sense. I mean, the logic was there, and it has to do with writing down NOLs to a zero tax value, even though you may be subject to a minimum tax. So I, you know, between building the model of writing NOLs down to the production tax value that would yield the same tax as the minimum, so only use as much as I need to get to the minimum, writing them all the way down is a huge difference in how those NOLs get used. And, you know, just intuitively you'd expect if I've got a $10 billion project and I cut the NOLs in half, that means I'm cutting my deductions by $5 billion. If I'm in a 35% tax bracket for those deductions, about $1.8 billion, if I pay federal tax on it, I should get a credit of somewhere around $1.4 or something to the state, or a detriment to the producer. And the numbers were coming up about one quarter of that. And so it's a nuance that I don't fully understand, and my rule is if I don't fully understand it and I don't think it's exactly accurate, I'm not going to present it. So that's why the DR presented the full cycle model. Until we can really sort through this, we don't want to show. But what that does say, and then I'll go back to my first presentation to you, is when you start having lots and lots of moving parts instead of one or two moving parts, you know, how these things all interact. What are the rules for what comes first? You know, losses, NOLs, then if it's credits, is it the per barrel credit? Is it a tax credit based on an NOL? Is it a tax credit through one of the other mechanisms that you get credits, many of which are expiring but still there? It just raised a lot of questions, so we didn't do it. Now, that's the bad news. The good news, what we have is, I think, something that would be very useful and informative for you, is we put together what I call a snapshot one-year model. So what you see down the left-hand side is we can change any of the parameters that are in yellow that you see up here on the screen. So we've broken the state down into about 450,000 barrels a day of non-GVR production and 50 of GVR. If anyone has a better guess, we can plug it in and use it. But we can then change the cost structure. We can change tax rates, GVR rates, federal rates, royalty percentages, as well as put in different ways of doing the gross minimum tax. We can change the sliding barrel to whatever. It can match what's in there. And then what the two plots on the right-hand side of the screen will do is the one on the top is for non-GVR fields. So that will be the that will show you the net effective tax on the left-hand scale, which goes from zero at the bottom to 50% at the top. I know the number's a little small. And the line right now, which is flat, is the revenue to the state, and this is in the current status quo position. So as we make changes, what you'll see is change to the net tax curve, which will then cause a change to the either plus or minus to the state. Go ahead and change like the per barrel starting to 5. So now you can see we made one change. Instead of starting at $8 a barrel on the per barrel credit, we started at 5, all else being equal. So what you can see on the graph now is the orange kind of hockey stick looking curve or big spoon looking curve is the status quo. With the change we made in the credits, the net tax curve moved to the blue, which is slightly above it. And then the green curve, you'll see, stays on zero. Now the green curve you read to the right axis, and the right axis goes from minus $600 million to $1.4 billion at the top. So what you can now see where the green curve comes up and over is at that price. So we go to a price on the x-axis or the horizontal, go up to the green curve, and for that one change you can read that if the price in the market is that price, for example, right there on the corner, you'll see that point right there at $80 ANS West Coast, that if I change the sliding scale to start at 5 instead of 8, the state would pick up at $80 another $404 million. Now, the accuracy of our work, this is not fiscal note accuracy. But what I'm saying, by putting a number up like 400, probably somewhere between 375 and 425. But it gives you an indication that when you do something, of the order of magnitude of what that change will be to the state.
And clarification, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
So from what you're doing, and I just want to make sure that everybody understands, this is just about how much money that the state can take based on changing any of these factors. The piece, and I think you made it clear the other day, it might have been actually yesterday, that what it doesn't tell us is what's going to happen with how much oil is coming down the pipeline. So this is just basically saying if I move this or this, this is how much the state can make. But what these graphs won't tell us is the effect that it has on the companies as far as the production.
And Representative Wilson, to share, that's exactly right. What none of us really know except for the companies themselves is what their tipping point is. There's an amount that, you would say they might be able to absorb. They really don't want to, but they might be able to. But there's going to be a point at which you can get to where that will slow or stop their investment. I don't know what those points are. And those are decisions that become very particular to the companies themselves, what else is going on in the portfolio and what else they – and it's also what they run as their future forecast. The state has one future forecast on prices, et cetera. They run their own. And if theirs is more pessimistic, then that means small changes might be very detrimental. If it's more optimistic, that means small changes, although they won't like it, it really won't mean that much in their decision making.
And one more follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess what we need to be very careful about on this or any legislation is if we do too many levers at one time, we might not understand the full impact, positive or negative, mostly negative because I think we're in a positive right now, which would then almost bring us right back where we are right now, back to the table saying, what didn't we do correctly? Which one did we go too far? Versus if, and I think you said this earlier too, if our real issue here is not one to pay cash out any longer because we don't have the money to be able to do that and we're not paying them anyway, so there's probably not a benefit. By hitting just one thing, it gives a better next year when we look at what's happening, it would make it easier for us to understand whether it had a negative or a positive or maybe it was just neutral versus all these different ones you have up here.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that it is easier to do that, but you'd have to then be stepping each year to see just exactly where you could get to. So it's a matter of how you procedurally want to run that through. But that's the beauty of what we have here, is it allows you to either look at things collectively or look at things individually. Because the one thing this model will do, it will take into account the interrelationship between minimum hard floors or not hard floors, the sliding barrel credits changing at different rates, and that will give you an overall aggregate number. And then you can compare, one set of numbers to a second set to a third set until you're comfortable with kind of where you might want to be.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. It's just very concerning that just because the numbers might look good as far as what the state takes, that doesn't mean we necessarily have more oil going down.
And through the chair, Representative Wilson, you kind of brought up another question about what I said the other day, so I'm going to criticize ourselves here on the flaw of averages, is that what we are doing is using in here an average transportation and an average cost. And I understand the fallacy of that is that there are likely fields that have cost structures that are lower and those that are higher. I mean, we're using the rough numbers that have been shown, but like we just commented, Conoco says at 40, they've got a 10% rate of return. I've got 40 just as the cost. So obviously there's some numbers, real numbers, that are different than the numbers that we've got up here. But the beauty of this model is you can change it. I can make the total instead of 10 and 30, I can make it 35. And you can see how the curve shifts left and right or up and down. And so that way you got an idea. So what we've done is, as I said, the plot in the upper right assumes that you have about 90% of the production in the state is non-GVR. And the plot on the bottom right is showing the same thing. Net tax plotted to the left scale, state take plotted to the right scale, and that's for 10% of the production in the state assumed to be GVR production. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Two questions. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I just can't see from here. You had the 0 to 5 adjustment up there. Can you put that back up? Would kick in somewhere between, I can't see, you tell me, somewhere between $65 and $70 a barrel, is that right?
Yes, this is 65. Representative Garrett through the chair, this is $65 here and roughly $75 at this crossover point of zero.
Through the chair.
At
what point does it start? What price roughly does it start having an impact over current law? I just can't see that where it starts having an impact.
That's at $65, Representative Gare.
Thank you. Then through the chair.
Representative Gare.
Yeah, this doesn't have to be right now, but I mean, I'm going to ask this question like forever until I hear it discussed. During the company testimony, we did hear a side of the story that left out the massive benefit a company can get in royalty relief. So if you went to 0 to 5, for example, the extra cost to the company can be far more offset than by the amount of reduction in their royalty from 12.5% or 16.5% royalty relief can reduce that by 7 to 11% in gross tax points, right? So, I mean, wouldn't royalty relief, if you got the full amount of royalty relief, if you proved it to the state that you needed it to make the field economic, wouldn't that vastly exceed for companies the benefit of to the state of the 0 to 5 change?
Representative Garrett, the chair, let's put something up, and I think if we can show this to Ron. If you let in the 50, 56, 62 on the minimum tax.
Do you want to leave the max credit at 5 or change that back to 8?
Let's run sort of what's recommended. No, we're going to set up what's Representative Gare. We're going to set up what's in the bill. So we'll put in the 50, 56, and 62 on the gross minimum. That rate that puts in the 6, 7, 8%. And then down on the per barrel credits, I think we're starting at 60. And we're cutting it off not at 0, but at 3, and then going to 0 at 120. So by putting all that in, you then go up to the green line, which is the state take. And you'll see that roughly in the price range of 70 to 80, it's about a $200 million benefit to the state by changing those parameters the way in which they were changed. Now, I'm going to put you in this world of make-believe that we have a 450,000-barrel field that we just subjected to these new terms. So then you might ask, how much royalty relief would they need to bring them back to zero? If they're actually just running barely economic right now, and you put these new terms on them, what royalty would we have to go down to? So go ahead, Christina, take that down.
What are you going to take it down to? And try it at 10.
That's about 10.
Yeah.
So as you can see, taking 2.5 points off the royalty, other than one blip at around $130, $140 a barrel, we've just about zeroed out the revenue. So knowing that with royalty relief, you could go from 12.5 on an existing field, which most of the non-GBR are, you go down to 3. So you've got 9% of royalty relief to play with. We just took 2.5 off, and you can negate the changes made to the gross minimum and to the per barrel sliding credit scale.
Just so I,
Representative Guerra.
Just so I have that clear, and I may have misheard you, but if you did a, are you saying if you did a 5% minimum at 56 at 56 and 7 at 62 and you did the 0 to 5, you could wipe out the increase in revenue to the state with just 2% of royalty relief? Or did I misunderstand that?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, you understood it accurately.
Thanks.
Further questions?
I mean, we're here to run whatever's...
We have more as we go along here. One question in the Fates presentation that there was a statement there that I didn't quite get, but it was something like, if we went to 100% carry forward of the expenditures, and those were written off over the first life of the field, and I guess it was maybe the minimum tax interaction with that. Was that that line that came up so that there was still red bars underneath that green line, and that was the effect of the minimum tax? Is that what that?
Chair Seaton, yes, that's exactly what she was trying to show, is that in those early years when they are deducting and recovering the capital that they had spent, I believe the project that she had shown had a 5-year investment period. So once production starts and they start writing it off, is you will then use those deductions to take your tax value down to zero. However, a minimum tax could still apply. And then that's when, with a hard floor, a minimum tax would kick in. So there would be an amount of tax to be paid each and every one of those years, even though they had large amounts of carry forward losses to deduct.
Representative Guerra?
Yeah, just and I missed on your leaving out royalty relief and whether or not a company needs it. What did you at the, let's say it's 60, 70, and 80, what did you say the extra revenue was of going from 5, 6 to 7 and doing the 0 to 5% credit at those price points?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, at a $60 price point, we are looking at $135. At a $70 price point, we're looking at roughly $240. And at an $80 price point, we are looking at roughly $270.
Just one other question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah, and are those, if you did the 5 to 6 to 7 at those prices, and the 0 to 5 credit kicks in at $65 a barrel, those are alternative, right? Those aren't stacking on top of each other, or do they stack on top of each other? I think they're alternative. But.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, the results that you see in the graph is additive of all the different changes that were made. If you want to look at any one in particular, we just have to reset the ones that you you know, and only impact and change the one that you want to look at. So if you're interested in just the impact of, for example, the gross minimum tax bracket, we can just put the per barrel credit back to where it is now, and then you can look and see the impact of just that change, or vice versa. We can do it the other way around.
Representative Garrett, the figures that I gave you are with the per barrel credit range from $8 to $3. So did you want to see that from 5 to 0?
Sure.
Okay, at the $60 price point, it's roughly $135. At the $70 price point, roughly $240. And at the $80 price point, roughly $670.
And what was it at 80 under the 3 to 8?
Let me go back so I can tell you correctly. Okay, Representative Guerra, the figure is roughly 270.
270 at 80, okay.
Yes.
Thanks.
And down on the bottom graph, would you explain that one again?
Right hand is GVR. So for example, maybe one of the things you wanted to do was to create a hard floor. So Christine, if you'll change hard floor to yes.
Let me set everything back to normal.
Yeah, she's gonna try and set zero everything back to normal. As you can see, just putting a hard floor, it starts to show that you'll pay a minimum tax, but with the size of the field being fairly small, never in my life would I call 50,000 small, but relatively small in terms here that we're talking about, you'll see that that the minimum tax kicks in roughly, where, Christina?
This is roughly $90.
So roughly $90, A&S West Coast is where the minimum tax would kick in with the hard floor. But the amount of money that it would bring in is small.
Tiny, sub 10.
Yeah, plus or minus $10 million. Now, where you can change that is if we go back and input that gross minimum changes that we talked about, or we had in there for the previous one, you'll see that with the hard floor, they're paying minimum tax from roughly $115 a barrel. So regardless of what deductions and credits they had, they would use them all, but they would still be subject to a minimum tax up to $115. So only at prices above that, you know, would that really be an impact. But now let's take a new field, and let's say its total transport is 20 instead of 10. And its cost is 40 instead of 30 because it's a brand new field, a little more expensive. Now you see what starts to happen. I'm going to point to the top plot first. As you'll see that as you increase your cost structure, your curve moves up and to the right. Because the 35% is fixed at your 150 a barrel, I mean, that's what we talked about before, about fixing something on price. Instead of the whole curve kind of shifting to account for the changing cost structure, the right-hand side of that curve stays fixed, and the left-hand side is moving to it. So you've got much less room between, where you're at and ultimately when you pay the 35% tax. You can see based on the shape of it, it's when it's at the bottom there, on the top one. Again, if you're the non-GVR, you're now way up under that cost structure and the higher minimums. You're at roughly, what there, Christina,
105.
At $105 and below, you're going to be subject to minimum tax. And then you can see the change that it has in the overall take to the state is actually negative, and it gets highly negative because you're talking about a much higher tax structure than you have, I mean a cost structure than you have today, and so you have much less intake at every price point along the way because there's less profit to be able to share. And then again, when you look at the bottom one for the GVR field, you can see again we've shifted the point way over, that with a hard floor and those increases in the minimum tax percentages at those points, is you're out at $145 a barrel and below, a GVR field would be subject to the minimum tax. Now, before someone says, well, wait a minute, once we're over 70, there's not supposed to be any GVR. This is a one-year snapshot, so you have to make believe that if 1 year jumped to 140, this is where they would be. Obviously, if it stayed there for a couple years or 3 years, then GVR goes away, and actually that field just moves from the bottom graph to the top graph. And so the top graph would show you where they're at as well. But you can also see that sort of the net effective tax, when you look at the tax that they ultimately have to pay relative to the profit that they're making, shifts up considerably on that as well as you change these parameters. Is there anything else you'd like to see run?
So would you go back to, you know, status quo and then put in the
no.
111 the way it is now as far as the per barrel credit?
Chair, I think that's 60 as a start price, $8 a barrel, and every $10 increment, we go down a dollar until we hit 3, and then we jump to 0. And that's what we have input now. You see the results in the upper right-hand plot. Why don't you give them the values?
Mr. Chair, at the $80 price point, we're looking at an increase to the state of $270 million. Which is relatively flat until $120 price point, the increase to the state being about $540 million.
And that increase, that bump up, what is that? Is that related to going to zero? No. Trying to figure out why.
This is between the 120.
Credit.
Representative Chair Seaton, what happens with the change that you made? You brought the point at which 35% tax is payable from 150 plus down to 120 plus. That's why you see the blue line is flat at 35 all the way back to 120. And for the prices from 80 on upwards, you basically put in a $2 a barrel increment. So the initial jump up to a flat portion is, during that flat portion, it's just a standard $2 a barrel difference. So you take that $2 a barrel times the number of barrels. But then when it makes that jump from 3 down to 0, you create a larger gap. And that's why it jumps up the additional amount to cover that gap. And then with each $10 increment, it's coming back down again until the two tax rates are equal and then the revenue to the state's equal.
Could you walk through that again?
Yeah.
That scenario.
Yes, would you do that? And would you
point?
Would you identify exactly which points and at what price we're doing the per barrel credit change? From status quo.
Chair Seaton, what we've done relative to the status quo is to make one change, which is just the sliding barrel credit change. And you can see from where the market is, we've changed the starting price from 80 where the decrement starts. So instead of going 0 to 80 by putting in 60, it says from 0 to 60, the highest credit will apply, which in this case is $8. The price step of 10 says every $10, we're going to decrement the credit. and that credit's going to start at 8, which is the max credit, if you show the 8, and then every time there's a credit step, which is every $10 change in the price, we decrement that by 1 until we hit 3 as the minimum credit, and then after 3 it falls off to 0. So you can see in the table down below where we set the parameters, it sits there and calculates out and sets all those parameters up to feed into the model. So then if we go up to the results, what's happening is at the point where the revenue line jumps up initially is where there's a difference in the credit that is available under the current legislation versus the credits that would be available under the committee substitute HB 111. And that difference originally becomes $2 a barrel. Because I'm starting at 60 instead of 80, by the time I get to 80 with this example, I'm at 6 instead of 8. So I'm at $2 a barrel, and I'm at $2 a barrel for roughly 150 million barrels a year, so that should be about $300 million. Plus or minus with
270 million.
Yeah. And so that $2 difference stays in place as I go to 90, as I go to 100, as I go to 110. That $2 difference between what you have now and what we just changed it to remains. So it's just an extra $2 a barrel that with taxes paid. But then once we hit 120, the new drops off to 0. And the other is still at 3, so I'm at a, I'd say it's still at 4, so I'm at a 4 to 0, so I'm at a 4 difference, and then every $10 after that, it keeps coming down until the two tax rates equate when the per barrel credit is 0 on both cases. Representative Gutberg, did that answer your question?
A little bit.
Perhaps can you change that to the back to the original SB 21 that had $5 flat tax rate per barrel at all prices?
The original 80
and 8 to 0? Chairman, so you're talking about just 5 flat across the board?
5 flat across the board. I mean, having trouble her getting the relational values here.
Put 200. Just put 200 and put 5 to 0.
Okay, that works.
And Chairman, see, basically the way we just set this up, it makes the per barrel credit $5 a barrel flat all the way up to $200 a barrel, which is the width of our plot.
What? Okay, and why are the steps showing there? I guess I'm not understanding the steps in relationship to a constant $5 per barrel credit.
Chairman, seat through the chair. What you're seeing is that the status quo has the barrel credit changing every $10. So when I put in a 5 flat, what you're seeing is the fact that when it's 8 and you're doing 5 flat, there's a 3 difference, so that will be the positive 3 for $10. Then when the current goes down to 7, it drops again to 6 to 5, then all the way to 0 until I have a flat $5 difference. Because under the current at 150, you go to 0 on the sliding barrel, and we're doing a 5 flat all the way across the board. So that stair step you see is actually the delta impact of the current 8 down to 0 in $1 increments every $10 in price.
So if the line is flat going across, that's not showing per barrel, that's showing the status quo, and so we're looking at changes from the status quo. Is that
Chair Seaton, the change that you requested was a flat change the sliding, make sure I got this right. You asked that the sliding scale that went from 8 to 0 be changed to a 5 flat.
Yes.
Okay. Isn't a 5 flat, right? Because it's still stair stepping. So
well, it's a 5 flat to 200, and as far as our plot goes, it's 200. So what you're seeing on the revenue curve that kind of goes up and then steps down is when that $5 credit is either less than, equal to, or more than the credit that would have been allowed under the current system.
Okay. So the current system is showing as a straight line across at zero.
Correct.
And so everything that we're seeing is just in relationship to the current system, which is a flat line going across the screen.
Chair, that's exactly right. If we set the parameters they are today, the green line that represents state take would be a flat straight line at zero.
Okay. Didn't have the understanding of that quite right to begin with, so.
It's not to say that the state has zero take. It's just that's our baseline from which we're operating, because I think when you start looking at changes like this, you can have this particular run made or that particular run made, and you've got a single number here and a single number there. What we developed here for you to use and ready to make it available is you could basically play with putting in whatever you would like to put in and to test with respect to any of these parameters and to get an idea of the impact that it would have. And I think for some that, you know, have a little bit of time, it's kind of useful to play with it, because then it gives you a sense of kind of the relative importance or magnitude of one parameter versus another. Because you can find something that sounds big, but it doesn't make that big of a change. And you can have other things that doesn't sound that big. Let's just change the starting price from 80 to 40, and let's just cut this from 6 to 2 or something like that. Those can have very major changes with respect. So this will just be a tool that will help you understand that whatever you choose to do, you'll have an idea of the magnitude as you make that decision.
Oh, good. I think that'll help people play with this model better, knowing that that is the current system, so anything we're seeing is a change from it, even though it's not showing the $5 or, I mean, this is all built in at the current 8 and then step down. So,
Chair, that's exactly correct. And the same goes for the GBR. We haven't played much there with changing the GBR percentage, but you can do that. The $5 flat per barrel credit, you can change that as well. That's available. And you can either turn on or turn off a hard floor, and therefore it's either impacted or not impacted by gross minimum and any changes that you do there. And that'll be reflected in the bottom curve.
Very good. Further questions? Anybody want to have anything particular modeled? I guess when we have the GVR fields, can you show us what that is at 30% versus the 20%? And so at that 30%, and what is the difference at which?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, could you repeat the question?
I'm trying to figure out what the different price is where it crosses the state income line there.
Mr. Chair, in this case, the effect is negative to the state, and so at roughly the $80 price point, you're at minus $16 million, which steps down. For example, at the $110 price point, you're at minus $52
million. And so at $80 and below that is... Or what's that? Is that 80 there?
This is $80 here, yes, at negative $16 million to the state. Below $80, there is no change.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Guerra.
The chair. I guess I always struggle with the GVR. I certainly didn't support it when it passed. I guess what is your opinion of granting this reduced tax rate to the fields that fall in the GVR provision with all the other things that we have in the law in terms of, I guess I'd ask you in terms of why state policy, what is your opinion on this GVR provision we have in the law?
Representative Garrett, within your law you've made some provisions for things you'd like to see happen. You want South Central Gas, so Cook Inlet has its own tax system, which is extremely favorable, relatively speaking. A dollar a barrel for oil and cheap gross on gas. But you did that because you wanted to cause certain activity to occur, and hopefully that draws that activity. For the same thing, another one of, I believe, your long-term goals is to fill the pipeline. And I think what you have to decide is what is the right incentive to get new large fields on the North Slope developed to keep the life of that pipeline going longer. I don't have a feel. That's why I said earlier I want to get my big model running so I can get a feel and make sure I've got all the pieces working right with respect to when NOLs come in, when credits come in, when MINs come in. Because it's only then after that I'd be able to tell you whether or not that's okay and it's not enough or it's too much. But given that one of your main goals is to fill the pipeline, then as a state you need to be looking at things that will cause those new fields to come on.
For the chair. What if the goal was to increase production, increase production that with the state investment in the field and then the production taxes we get later and the royalties we get later, I guess my goal would be to fill the pipeline with oil that makes money for the state, not to fill the pipeline with oil where we lose money. So let me ask you this. I've seen analysis that even at $110 a barrel, that was back when the GVR was infinite, not just for 7 years, but Scott Goldsmith, I don't know if you ever saw it, but he did an analysis that showed that there was a near zero, if not negative, net present value for GVR oil back then to the state. Do you know anything? Is that just analysis beyond you? And then I guess my benchmark is I don't want to spend money in oil that's not making money for the state.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, the example that I showed yesterday with the sort of the same amount of money being handled four different ways time-wise, it was something that, for the operator went from a 6% rate of return to the 27, and, with the state getting money in there. But the one that really changed the value to the state and the value to the producer in opposite directions was the one where you paid 35% up front as cashable credits. I think part of what you have in the bill before you is the idea that you don't pay up front, but in essence the state contributes through the non-take of tax to the when the operator recovers through deduction their costs. And so actually the state's not out anything until that producer is able to produce a barrel of oil in order to take that deduction. So there, I think in going from the realm that you were in of paying cashable credits, personally, I would have never done that. I mean, I could be paying for stuff and the barrel of oil never show up. But you can give the same incentive tied to production actually coming in. And I think that's part of what you try to do with the GVR and the $5 barrel is to give credit for when the production actually shows up.
Representative
So that's the GVR question. This uplift, I'd never heard the term uplift as a interest rate before. So, because I just play an oil person on TV, but to me, I guess just sitting here, we allow companies a benefit that we essentially pay for either up front or later on in terms of deductions. And then we pay 8% on top of that. I might have a hard time going back to my constituents explaining why I'm giving somebody 8% on money that I'm giving to companies, essentially. And I'm wondering if there's an uplift percentage that could be reasonable that isn't 8%, because 8% is a lot to my constituents. They don't make that in the stock market.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, actually, when you look at a 50-year curve, that's about the average return on equities is around 8%. You know, whether 8 is the right number or something smaller or something larger, it's just something to talk about. But the term uplift, the use of uplift, is very common in the industry. It obviously, in lower 48 tax and royalty, where there's only the gross severance, it's not present. But I think, again, as we talked about yesterday, the reason why you see the companies, especially large companies, invest many billions of dollars in countries that have tax rates much higher than here is they don't deduct their costs, they recover their cost. And they recover those costs with interest or uplift. And that is the norm. So if I take the fact that, let's say I invest $1 billion, that I get to take the first $1 billion tax-free, take what uplift the government gave me tax-free, then I start paying a tax. Let's say it's a Norway or it's somewhere else at a 78 or an 80% rate. Compare that to here, where what they're allowed to do is deduct, so they get the benefit of just the tax rate or the 35%. So if they spent that $1 billion, they deduct, and let's just say they put in their pocket an extra $350. And so they're only getting $350 back here for their spending of $1 billion, and then they pay the tax. In another regime, they're going to get $1 billion plus back for their $1 billion before they start paying the other tax. And when you put in the fact that they get to take that early, it adds up to considerable upside in their economics. And it's those economic parameters that are key when they decide where to invest. So, the question of, I think as a state, you've constantly asked, how do I compare to other regimes? And I think the comparison is more than just headline tax rates. It's all these other moving pieces that you have to take into account as well. So if Alaska were to allow full deduction with uplift, you're still not keeping up with a number of the other countries that offer much more lucrative recovery.
Yeah, you started the sentence, but I don't know if you necessarily meant that, but you said uplift or that benefit is greater, but you said in countries that have a much bigger government take than we do. Did you mean all countries or just primarily those places that take a more aggressive share?
Representative Garrett, the chair, there are countries that have a lower tax rate, effective tax rate, than you have here that offer full recovery with uplift or some degree of uplift, but I think a majority of those that I'm familiar with that have much higher take than Alaska does offer full recovery of cost with some form of uplift included in there as well.
Thanks.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So does how many take royalty in kind like we do where we take one barrel out of every 8? So does a lot of countries take royalty or do they just base it on taxes?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, and I can go on for about 20 minutes on the answer to this question. I'll try and make it short and sweet. If you're under a standard royalty and tax type concession regime, I know of very few that take the royalty in kind. There's a couple countries that I'm aware of where they run their own refineries and they need that as feedstock to the refinery because their oil company wants to export to their own refinery their share, that they will do it. But for the most part, it's a mixed bag of what countries do, whether they take it in kind or whether they take the value for it. A lot of times, too, it becomes strangely intermixed because sometimes the government take of what we call profit oil includes them paying taxes on behalf of the operator. So part of the oil that they take is not only their share, but their share of paying taxes on behalf of the operator. And that's usually because that state take could be 80 or 90% of profit oil. So I hate to make it, it's a very complex answer to really go through what every other country does, but not that many that I'm aware of take royalty in kind.
So when you were talking, follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Reverend Wilson.
So when you're talking about paying, most countries or most regimes pay everything. So when we saw the graphs from Department of Revenue, so when we had that straight line for the first 5 years that the companies were investing, that's where more money would be paid in most regimes versus here we make the companies pay it all up front, and then we talk about cash flow credits or we talk about taking it off their taxes once they start producing. Is that where most regimes would be paying the money in the first 5 years?
Through the chair. The example that was shown is the project had a five-year investment period. In most of these other regimes, nothing goes to the operator in those 5 years. Everything goes out of the operator in those 5 years. The ability to recover those costs, and possibly with uplift, only occurs once there's production. And in many regimes, projects are ring-fenced, so they have to wait until they have production from that project in order to recover the cost associated with that project. So the state, other than if the state's an equity participant, the state doesn't participate and doesn't pay anything ahead of time. It's up to the producer to produce barrels in order to recover their money.
And one more follow-up.
Reverend Wilson.
So when those barrels start, then that's when we would be talking about the recovery of their cost and basically the interest rate as they get money back for the investment that they did after the barrels are starting to be produced.
Representative Wilson, the chair, yes. It's once production starts. And then you have the whole variety with countries as to those that say every barrel that's not royalty barrel can be used to recover your cost. And there's other countries that will put a limit on how many of the barrels can be used for cost recovery. So that way every year there's a bit of profit to the government.
Okay, and just
Representative Wilson.
And so when we go back to our constituents and we most of them don't even really want to talk about a lot of this, just us. But it's back to the big picture you told us yesterday, is that we have to take all of our pieces together and add all that up, whether it's the royalty oil that goes into our permanent fund so that we have a bigger permanent fund corpus in it, whether we're talking about, you know, the actual different kind of taxes that we have. When we're talking about government take, we need to make sure that we have that full number in it. Because, again, if we're piecing it all out, then it's hard to really do an apple-to-apple comparison because each field is doing improvements at different times, getting different amount of oil each time. So, but wouldn't that be the discussion that we really have to have, is the complete number, not just one piece at a time?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, if you're actually looking at one of your goals, which is to bring new projects on to fill the pipe, you would need to have a full project model, even if it's a guesstimate of what they're doing, so that way you can look at the interplay of all the pieces. Because, as I said, as we've just been working with it, you're getting results that are not typical that I'm used to seeing. Not that there's an error, it could be just the interplay between the various parameters. And you need to know that so that way you make decisions in the right direction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I think the thing that we haven't discussed at this table and again is what happens if we get down to a certain amount of oil going down the pipeline, what happens when we get below a certain number and all the consequences can happen. I think that's a lot of the tax changes we've made and why we're so devoted to putting more barrels down the pipeline is because the negative consequence, if we get down so far, what happens to the pipeline itself? And there's been times where we've been heading that way faster than we wanted. Thank you.
Are there questions? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pretty technical graph, and I really appreciate it. I'm not sure actually how much I will stick. But we've had some lessons, and we've learned over the years that a life cycle of a field, what it is, and when the majors come in, and how they evolve out, and it seems like Prudhoe Bay, with its continuing discoveries and with with Smith Bay, there seems to be a lot of oil left. How, in a normal field in someplace else, what would we be seeing now? Would we be seeing the majors selling off their assets, or are we just looking for their behavior? Are they sticking around because they believe that there's more money to be made, or, you know, they start selling off stuff and they kind of exit out, and, you know, Apache and all those guys have, you know, work around the peripheral. So what are we seeing on a big, you know, 35,000 view of what's happening there, and what would the expectation be for them to stick around and say that there's more oil, whether it's in PRA or Anwar or another Smith Bay, or kind of what is kind of an assumption outside would say they normally would be leaving now, or why are they staying?
Representative Greg, to the chair, pure speculation on my part.
Sure.
Just based on experience and not anything that where I've talked to anybody. But there's a slide that I've used in conference speeches and other talks and that I've given over the last 10 years. And generally, you can look around the world, and a lot of the good fields that were found and developed by the super majors, you get 30, 35 years out, and they divest. And part of that divestment comes because I think the management, I know when I was there, one of my key metrics for my payouts was dollars per barrel and cost control. And it was also cost control relative to my competitors. We had a suite of companies we were compared against. And when you're driven like that, when fields get old and have high fixed costs, they tend to leave because the price per barrel goes up and they really can't control much from there. But they, and the fact that they haven't left the North Slope, where they've left all these other areas or these other fields, tells me, my speculation, that there's huge upside potential sitting there, that they believe there's a lot more to be had, and it's just a matter of it coming to fruition in its own time for Alaska and its own time within their portfolio. But I've not seen them stay with something as long as they've stayed here on one project, unless there's good potential.
Okay, and just a follow-up.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. In a conversation I've had some other place, it was part of the, and we're really kind of getting a field here, but we only have you for a certain amount of time. But you know, the TAPS and its valuation and its history. You know, it's theoretically it can go for a long time left, long time yet. The major investments in Prudhoe Bay and the facilities and the pipelines and the roads, the ability to just walk away from that for the majors who put all that into it, what is their risk if they allow the TAPS to go below its ability to function in the winter and it shuts down? Are there SEC risks, or there conversations that what they're putting their assets at risk?
Representative Gutenberg, to the chair, I always believe that the companies will act prudently and in best interest that they can. And if production falls and they're not bringing on other potential sources that they might know of, it would be because they're not economical to do so. We have to face it, they're profit-driven companies. And they're going to run their economics. And as fortunate as we see sometimes when things are driven by profits instead of by goodwill or thinking about this, that, or the other, they do get driven by those profits. And so they'll take a look at the economics, and that will help drive their decision on what they do. And hopefully where you get to as a state is not having to think about that for another 30 years because they're bringing on other potential sources of supply and filling that pipeline for quite some time to come.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Just giving a question.
Yes.
It's 3:35, and so the next House Finance Committee meeting will be at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, Saturday, March 25th. We will have public testimony on House Bill 111, get input from people across the state, and so see everybody here, and it is 3:37, and we're adjourned.